Alright, today is our 22nd day of the second month, and we're going to be continuing in Judges chapter 10 for our Sabbath Bible study. And last week we looked at Abimelech, and we looked at the story between him and Jotham, and as being the first king of Israel that is recorded biblically. And so in finishing up with that, chapter 10 starts out with saying, "And after Abimelech there arose to defend Israel Tola, the son of Pua, the son of Dodo, a man of Issachar, and he dwelt in Shemer, in Mount Ephraim, and he judged Israel 23 years and died and was buried in Shemer." So we're not really told a whole lot about this Tola fella, except for how long he defended Israel and judged them, which we can see here a connection between verse 1 out of chapter 10 and verse 2 out of chapter 10, which connects the idea of defending or delivering with the idea of judging to understand the difference. And as we've said in the past several times now, that the word judge referenced here in the book of Judges refers to someone who is clarifying issues to the people. They make things clear to the people. And while every judge, as we have seen and will see, continues to have their problems, their earthly, fleshly problems, their sins, their issues, they were undoubtedly called by God to perform certain acts, sometimes seemingly miraculous acts, in order to judge Israel or clarify things to Israel. And the clarification process is pretty easy to see. It's the same one mentioned in Deuteronomy chapter 30, which we covered many, many months ago now. And that's pretty simply, choose this day who you will serve, as Joshua said, or choose life and death, blessing and curse. Pretty much there is no different option when it comes to Yahweh. Yahweh defines righteousness, and he defines goodness, and he defines blessing. He defines cursing. He gives us right and wrong and an understanding of what is right and what is wrong. So in saying that, we can see that the job of the judge during this period of Israel, when Israel did not have a king, that the judge was used in the place of judgment for clarification and for deliverance, to help Israel make the right choice. And most of the times, that right choice is to break away from bondage and serve Yahweh again. Okay, that's pretty much the number one choice being offered that Israel is to choose. And what they keep doing, as we'll read again, is they keep rebelling, they keep doing the wrong things, committing sins, and God rejects them for a period of time, and they come crying back to him again. So, picking back up in verse 3, Jair, we're told about. After him arose Jair, a Gileadite, and he judged Israel 22 years. And he had 30 sons that rode on 30 asses' colts, and they had 30 cities, which are called Havoth Jair unto this day, which is in the land of Gilead. Okay, this Havoth Jair just simply means the villages of Jair. And apparently this guy was elevated to a pretty high position in order to have that status, that all of his 30 sons were to have 30 cities and they or villages, and they're being treated almost as kings, riding upon the ass of a colt, which we know is a symbology of someone who is anointed or somebody put in a high estate. We see Christ doing the same thing once we get into the prophecies that are mentioned of him that he fulfills when the palms are thrown down before him, as you would read in the Gospels. We're told then in 5 that Jair died and he was buried in Kamon. And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of Yahweh, and they served Balaam and Ashtaroth, and the gods of Syria, the gods of Zidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the children of Ammon, the gods of the Philistines, and they forsook Yahweh, and they served not him. Now let's remember one thing, okay? The word Balaam can either mean Baal worship, which there are different forms of Baal, very similar to the way Buddhism deals with Buddha. Baal had different forms. You had Beelzebub, for instance, the Lord of the Flies. Prior, we read about Baal-Berith, which was the Lord of the Covenant. We have Baal-Zephon mentioned in other places, which is also the name of a place. And we have multiple Baals throughout the Bible. There's a Lord of this and a Lord of that. Very similar also to how maybe the Catholics perceive saints in their religion. You have one guy to pray to when you lose something, and one guy to pray to when your children are sick, and one guy to pray to whenever you need to get married. And this is the same concept, I believe, as what is being offered in Baal worship. Okay, there was an idol or an image, not different from the Catholic persuasion of St. Francis or St. this or St. Jude or St. that. But that image represents something. Okay, the Lord of something. The Lord of some aspect, whether it's the Lord of the harvest or the Lord of fertility or the Lord of making deals, covenants. The Lord of anything is mentioned by the name of Baal biblically. Okay, he's the master or the Lord of that. So I want to remind us that the Baals that Israel worshipped seemingly, and I think provably, have an Yahweh base. In other words, the people may not have been straying away from the Bible or the law altogether. They just simply attached an image and attached a meaning to the Baal that they worship, the God that they chose to worship, for whatever reason. Not much different than the Canaanites did, because the Canaanites' chief deity was Baal. And the Canaanites' father of Baal was El, which means God. It just simply means God. So you had God, who was the father of the Lord. Okay? And we see a very similar connection to the biblical faith when we look at it. So it's my opinion that maybe as far back as Noah or Enoch or one of those guys that we have a divergence in religion where we start calling Yahweh by different names and giving him different aspects. And this is how we have Israelites who don't find it too hard to worship in these different ways. This was happening during the time of Jer, or right after the time of Jer, rather. And the people decided that they were going to serve Balaam, okay? And they decided they're going to serve Ashtaroth, okay? Ashtaroth is an interesting word because it refers specifically to the stars, all right? And it's the word that we have still to this day when we hear the word Esther. Okay, the woman out of the Bible named Esther was named after Ashtaroth, most likely. And the word that we have today in our English language, star, is a derivative of Ashtaroth also. Astrology, okay, is where we hear that as well. So, it's not to say that this was star worship in and of itself, but that this person had a specific star and used the stars in specific ways, and this was a goddess. Okay, Ashtaroth was a goddess, which is indicated by the TH at the end of the word, all right, because that is a feminine plural, meaning that this is not dealing with just one. And we still have her day with us today, celebrated by every good Catholic and good Protestant who has not looked into their Bible to find out that it's not a biblical holiday, and that's called Easter, okay, which at one time was called Ashtar, or Oster in the Anglo-Saxon world. This was worshipped, this deity or being was worshipped as a goddess of fertility in connection with the spring from Ireland all the way to Babylon and Iran. Okay? This is a pretty far-stretching religion that covers a lot of ground, and we still have it with us today. And so we're told that Israel served Balaam, or the lords, and Ashtaroth, the female deities, okay, and on top of that, they needed to serve Elohim of Syria, and the Elohim of Zidon, and the Elohim of Moab, and Ammon, and the Philistines. So these are plural gods of all the people. Israel is deep into polytheism right now, which all happens from tolerance. tolerance is the key to getting a religion like this one. In other words, when you have all of these people, the Philistines, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Zidonians, the Syrians, the people who worship Ashtaroth and Baal, when you have all of these people showing up into your land in times of prosperity, when Israel's doing well, in the times of Jer, where there's 30 princes riding on 30 colts and have 30 villages, and they say, you know what, we're going to be nice to all these other people for 22 years. We're going to let them come in, and they're going to teach us their religion. They're going to tell us how the Philistines worship their sea god, and they're going to tell us how the Ashtaroth people worship their star god, and we're going to learn their ways, and we're going to be tolerant towards them because God has blessed us, and we want to share our religion with them. That's the type of mentality we have in Christian lands, or had, since we're not really Christian lands anymore. But 100 years ago, you'll find that when Europe was being prosperous prior to World War II and World War I, that we thought that we could just share our light with everybody and let people in. And what happened is the same thing that happened here in Judges 10:6, that they let the people in, and then the people forsake Yahweh, the God of the Bible, and they serve not Him. Okay? And how do we know how to serve Yahweh? Well, one really clear way is to follow the Bible, to follow God's law. When God's law is followed, you worship Yahweh. When God's law is not followed, you are not worshiping Yahweh. It's pretty simple. When people are trying, although they may not be following Yahweh, they are still at least worshiping Him by trying. Trying to learn, trying to add to their understanding. In this case, this is a complete reversal. They don't worship Yahweh. They go back to some other form of worship that people brought with them. So what happens? Verse 7. The anger of Yahweh is kindled hot against Israel, and He sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the children of Ammon. So Yahweh chooses two people that they allowed into their lands, and their religions into their lands due to a good tolerance policy. And He says, you know, the Ammonites and the Philistines will make great masters for you. If you want to serve their gods, they can teach you all about it while you're their slaves. And so Yahweh turns His back on Israel and gives them into their hands. Now, it's interesting because in what people call the New Testament, which is something that we had just read this morning, in John chapter 8, we're told about sin and being a servant to sin or being a son of sin, and how the servant abides not in the house forever, but a son of sin will abide in the house forever. And if the Son will let you free, then you can be free indeed. Okay, John chapter 8 tells us that. And in this case, you're going to see a similar connection to Yahweh selling somebody into the hand of people due to their sin. Same exact concept that's being offered in Judges is offered by Christ in 8. While Christ does not talk about gods or people, He's talking about the whole concept that Yahweh is dealing with, the concept of selling people for their sins, which Christ came to redeem us from. Redemption is a price paid for you, or for me, or for anybody. And if you're redeemed, it means Christ sheds His blood and gives His blood in payment for your sin. You owe God a debt. You owe Him something that you cannot pay. And so Christ is going to do that for you, and that's how He's going to redeem you from the house of sin. In this case here, Israel's being sold into the house of the Philistines and the Ammonites due to their sin in worshiping their gods. 8 says, that year they vexed and oppressed the children of Israel 18 years. Okay? So starting on that year, for 18 years, Israel was vexed and oppressed. That were on the other side Jordan in the land of the Amorites, which is in Gilead. Okay, so we're talking about the other side Jordan. That would be Reuben and Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh that were given that land on the other side before they entered the river. So what's being told to us here is this is where this tyranny or this oppression, this servitude started. It started on the other side of Jordan. Okay? And that's where Yahweh started this from, which would make sense because the Philistines, I believe, would just be a little bit north there of them, and the Ammonites would be just beside them. In that year they vexed and oppressed the children of Israel, we're told, those that were on the other side of Jordan, in the land of the Amorites, which is in Gilead. Moreover, the children of Ammon passed over Jordan to fight against Judah and against Benjamin and against the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was sore distressed. Now we have to remember that when we're talking about the house of Ephraim, we're not talking about the tribe of Ephraim. Okay? This is a difference of wording for a reason. The house of Ephraim refers to the northern tribes. Okay? We're talking about those who are gathered under Ephraim's banner. Now the house had not been split yet in north and south, but we still see that there is a differentiation in the house of Ephraim. Okay? Which is Joseph's house that he governs. And the children of Israel cried unto Yahweh, saying, we have sinned against thee, both because we have forsaken our God and also served Balaam. And Yahweh said unto the children of Israel, did not I deliver you from the Egyptians and from the Amorites, from the children of Ammon, from the Philistines, the Zidonians and the Amalekites and the Maonites, when they oppressed you, and you cried to me, and I delivered you out of their hands? Yet ye have forsaken me and have served other gods, wherefore I will deliver you no more. What a grim statement. I will deliver you no more. Go and cry to the gods which you have chosen. Let them deliver you in the time of your tribulation. And the children of Israel said unto Yahweh, we have sinned. Do thou unto us as whatsoever seems good unto thee. Deliver us only, we pray thee, this day. And they put away the strange gods from among them, and they served Yahweh. And his soul was grieved then for the misery of Israel. There's a lesson to be learned here, probably one of the most important lessons in Judges. God got upset. Yahweh was completely sickened by Israel, back and forth. And he says, you chose your gods, go cry to the wood and the stone and the imaginations that the people have dreamed up. You go to them. You got plenty of them. They'll help you. Go try and see if they'll deliver you. And Israel's persistence, and here's the thing I think that should be learned about, that no matter how bad something gets, and even when God has turned his back on you, in other words, you've prayed and prayed and prayed and you've asked and asked and asked, and nothing seems to change, that you can't just throw your hands up in the air and say, God doesn't care, God doesn't listen, he gave us up, he forgot about us, he doesn't matter anymore. If I don't matter to him, then he doesn't matter to me, that kind of mentality. Because what we're told here is that Israel, instead of just telling Yahweh, please deliver us, they then put forward their best effort to show him that they were serious. People can talk all they want. This is called faith. They can talk all they want, and we can hear about the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen of a person's word, and they can never change a thing about who they really are. But whenever they start showing you by their fruits, like putting away the strange gods that were among them and serving Yahweh, which means following his law again, we see an earnest of that spirit being put forward. And then what's Yahweh say? Then Yahweh was grieved. In other words, prior to this, when they cry to Yahweh and say, God of our fathers, you know, you delivered our fathers from Egypt, deliver us now. Please, just do it. And Yahweh says, okay, I'll do it. And then after Yahweh saves them, they turn towards Yahweh again and serve him. And this time, he says, I don't want to save you anymore. I'm sick of you. You've bothered me. You bother me too much. In this case, Israel now puts their foot forward and says, look, we're going to throw the other gods away and we're going to just serve you and follow your law. And then Yahweh becomes compassionate again about them and loves them again and decides he's going to choose them and take them under his wing and deliver them. That's something I think very important for Israel of modern day to remember when people say, you don't have to follow God's law. You just have to put your faith and trust in Jesus or in God. Just be a good person. Not worry about what the Bible really says. That's legalism. Because the truth is whenever the Bible talks about Israel making a effort to change to get God's attention, they worship him by following his law. And whenever they do that, then Yahweh is knit and bonded to them again, and it shows that they are his people. So now listen to this response that's said right here. It says, they put away their strange gods from among them and served Yahweh, and his soul was grieved for the misery of Israel. And then this really great thing happened, and God, you know, delivered them immediately, right? No, it says, then the children of Ammon were gathered together, and they encamped in Gilead. So they make Yahweh happy, and they make Yahweh happy, and then what ends up happening is a war breaks out. So this war is about to break out. And the children of Ammon were gathered together, and they encamped in Gilead, and the children of Israel assembled themselves together, and they encamped in Mizpah. And the people and princes of Gilead said one to another, what man is he that will begin to fight against the children of Ammon? He shall be head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. So basically what we're seeing is there is a time, according to the book of Judges, when Israel is going to be obedient and make Yahweh happy with him, that war is the answer to changing the situation so that they can get their nation back. And they're going to come against this, and they make this proclamation, whoever leads us into battle against Ammon, this force that is greater than Israel, that man's going to be our head. He'll be our captain. He'll be the chief. And 11 picks up immediately and says, now, Jephthah, the Gileadite, was a mighty man of valor. And he was the son, it says here, of a harlot. And Gilead begat Jephthah. Okay. Now, this always starts kind of a problem in certain circles who want to believe that God will not use such people in his line of work. But it's obvious from the scriptures that in Jephthah's case here, there's very few ways that you can translate this to make his mother not a lewd woman, we'll call it. Okay? She obviously was not the type of person that everyone was proud of having in their family. And so, because of that, Jephthah is told from the very beginning when he's introduced who's going to be the judge of Israel. He's going to be this head of this captain. He is told to us ahead of time that here's his origins, here's where he comes from, which once again, strangely enough, because I didn't plan this in reading, John chapter 8 talks about this very thing. When the people say to Christ, they say, we be not born of fornication. Abraham's our father. You know, this isn't, we don't have a problem like this. You know, in this case, Jephthah was, you could say, born of fornication. In other words, he was probably conceived when his father was not married to this woman. And the woman was a lewd person. Two goes on to say, in Gilead's wife bare him sons, and his wife's sons grew up, and they thrust out Jephthah and said unto him, thou shalt not inherit in our father's house, for thou art the son, it says, of a strange woman. Now, in the King James says the word strange, which a lot of times would give us the idea of a stranger. In other words, she would have been a person of another descent, another race, or another ethnicity that was not forbidden, or was not allowed. But in the Hebrew, the word another is actually the same word, which is commonly. So it should read, or could read, thou art the son of another woman. In other words, all of Jephthah's brothers were from one woman, but he, on the other hand, was from one other woman who was a lewd person, a person that was not respected. So they're going to throw him out of the inheritance. They don't want to give him anything. And Jephthah fled from his brethren and dwelt in the land of Tob. And there were gathered vain men of to Jephthah, and they went out with him. I always find this interesting because it said the same thing of David whenever David, I believe in 1 Samuel 22 and 21, somewhere in that area, it tells us when he goes to the cave and hides from Saul that vain men, people who had debts, people who were upset with the government, people that couldn't hold jobs, you know, whatever that meaning is, these are people who are not of the best of society, the upstanding ones that make sure to pay their taxes and do what they're supposed to do. They gathered themselves first to David as well as they gathered themselves to Jephthah. Okay? And a lot of times people who are vain are also empty, easily swayed, because we read in Abimelech's story that vain men gathered themselves also to Abimelech. And as I had connected that with the idea of some people are swayed with every wind of doctrine, when someone's vain, they're empty. Now, under Abimelech, it says vain and light persons were gathered. In this situation, we're told it's just vain men, empty men, people that needed to be filled up. They weren't necessarily light and easily moved, like people who are swayed by every wind of doctrine, but they were people who were empty. They needed something to fill them up. They were deflated, like a balloon, okay? And they needed something to fill them up again. So they brought themselves to Jephthah to be refreshed, to be blown back up again, to be puffed up again. And that's where his first army came from. And then listen to the story. It came to pass in process of time, or in a period of days is how that could also be translated. It came to pass in the process of time that the children of Ammon made war against Israel. And it was so that when the children of Ammon made war against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to fetch Jephthah out of the land of Tob. And they said unto Jephthah, come and be our captain, that we may fight with the children of Ammon. And Jephthah said unto the elders of Gilead, do not you hate me, and expel me from my father's house? And why are ye come unto me now, when ye are in distress? And the elders of Gilead said unto Jephthah, therefore we turn again to thee now, that thou mayest go with us, and fight against the children of Ammon, and be our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. And Jephthah said unto the elders of Gilead, if ye bring me home again to fight against the children of Ammon, and Yahweh deliver them before me, shall I be your head? The elders of Gilead said unto Jephthah, Yahweh be witness between us, if we do not so according to thy words. Then Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead and the people, and he made him head over the captains of them. And Jephthah uttered all his words before Yahweh in Mizpah. So if you remember, Mizpah is where the tabernacle was kept at times. And so they actually went and made an oath in front of Yahweh that they would not cast him back out after he won the war. Okay? Now, the interesting thing about this is, if this were a Deuteronomy chapter 23 violation, which says a bastard shall not enter into the congregation of Yahweh, even unto the 10th generation, okay, or forever, if that were that type of bastard, which some people would like us to believe that it is, because he was the son of a harlot, which is not true, because he knew who his father was. His brethren could not have cast him out of his house if he didn't know who his father was. So number one, he couldn't possibly be part of the Deuteronomy chapter 23 bastard. And on top of that, he couldn't have been of a strange people, or else that would make him not able to be accepted into the congregation on that line either. And they would definitely not take him before Yahweh and make him swear before Yahweh against Yahweh's law that they would make a stranger to rule over them, which would be contrary to God's law once again. So we can definitely rule out a lot of things about Jephthah, and we can find out that the correct translation of 11:2 is the word another. And you could look at it from strange. I'm not saying that the King James is 100% wrong or it's wrong at all. But the idea is that he was from a different woman and these guys were just bitter against him. And so he made the elders of Gilead, the elders of his region, his area, swear to him that they would not cast him out again for unlawful reasons and that he would come and show that he was a man of valor again. Jephthah obviously had already proven that he was a fighter, because it calls him a man of valor, or a warrior, Geber, in the Hebrew. Okay? And because he was already known that, he must have done something in the past to prove himself, and they want him back again. Verse 12, "And Jephthah sent messengers unto the king of the children of Ammon, saying, What hast thou to do with me, that thou art come against me to fight in my land? And the king of the children of Ammon answered unto the messengers of Jephthah, Because Israel took away my land when they came up out of Egypt from Ammon, even unto Jabbok and unto Jordan. Now therefore restore those lands again peaceably. And Jephthah sent messengers again unto the king of the children of Ammon and said unto them, Thus saith Jephthah, Israel took not away the lands of Moab nor the lands of the children of Ammon. But when Israel came up from Egypt and walked through the wilderness under the Red Sea and came to Kadesh, then Israel sent messengers to the king of Edom, saying, Let me, I pray thee, pass through thy land. But the king of Edom would not hearken thereto. And in like manner they sent to the king of Moab, but he would not consent, and Israel abode in Kadesh. Then they went along through the wilderness, and they compassed the land of Edom, and the land of Moab, and came by the east side of the land of Moab, and they pitched on the other side of Arnon, but came not within the borders of Moab, for Arnon was the border of Moab. And Israel sent messengers unto Sihon, king of the Amorites, the king of Heshbon, and Israel said unto him, Let us pass, we pray thee, through thy land into my place. But Sihon trusted not Israel to pass through his coasts. But Sihon gathered all his people together, and he pitched in Jahaz, and he fought against Israel. And Yahweh, God of Israel, delivered Sihon and all of his people into the hand of Israel, and they smote them. So Israel possessed all the lands of the Amorites, the inhabitants of that country. And they passed all the coasts of the Amorites, from Arnon even unto Jabbok, and from the wilderness unto Jordan. So now Yahweh God of Israel has dispossessed the Amorites from before his people Israel, and shouldest thou possess it? Wilt not thou possess that which Chemosh thy God giveth thee to possess? So whomsoever Yahweh our God shall drive out from before us, them will we possess. And now art thou anything better than Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab? Did he ever strive against Israel, or did he ever fight against them? Well, Israel dwelt in Heshbon and her towns, and in Aor and her towns, and in all the cities that belong to the coast of Arnon. 300 years. Why therefore did ye not recover them within that time? Wherefore I have not sinned against thee, but thou doest me wrong to war against me. Yahweh the judge be judge this day between the children of Israel and the children of Ammon. Howbeit the king of the children of Ammon hearken not unto the words of Jephthah which he sent him." So what's Jephthah do? He goes back to the law, into the records in the book of Numbers, and into Deuteronomy chapter 2, primarily. I think Numbers chapter 20 and 21. And you can find exactly what it was that he is quoting to the king. And he's telling him, listen, here's the history. I got it written down. Certified copy of the law here that says this land's mine. I took it from the Amorites. I didn't take it from the Ammonites. I took it from the Amorites. And in the past, your king never tried to take it from me. For 300 years, you guys have sat quiet. Why would now you decide you're going to come and take the land? Either the king is confused, or he's just looking for a good reason to rally his people up to go fight against Israel. Either way, I particularly like the part in 24 where Jephthah tells him, live in the land that Chemosh gave you, your God. Yeah, that's where you're supposed to live, where you're at. Now, if you'll remember, if you'll go back and look at those places in the law where it talks about this, Yahweh specifically told them that you will not take any of the sons of Lot's possession. Ammon and Moab's land is not allowed to be taken. While Israel was not allowed to freely marry the Ammonites and the Moabites, they were not allowed to take their land. Okay? There was a strict division between the people, which wasn't a full division. The people did have some kind of commerce and change between the two of them, and they seemed to have get along a little better than they did with Canaanites. But at the same time, they were not allowed to take their land. God did not allow Esau's land, Moab or Ammon's land, any of the descendants of Nahor and Terah, none of their descendants were allowed to have their land dispossessed. God takes specific responsibility for saying that he gave that land to them. Then the Spirit of Yahweh came upon Jephthah, and he passed over Gilead and Manasseh, and he passed over Mizpah of Gilead, and from Mizpah of Gilead he passed over unto the children of Ammon. And that then there it says, Jephthah vowed a vow unto Yahweh, and he said, if thou shalt without fail deliver the children of Ammon into my hands, then it shall be that whatsoever cometh forth out of the doors of my house to meet me, when I return in peace from the children of Ammon, shall surely be Yahweh's, and I will offer it for a burnt offering. So Jephthah passed over unto the children of Ammon to fight against them, and Yahweh delivered them into his hands. Now, here is a case that we're going to eventually get into, which was called a hasty vow. When I can't help but think that when Solomon said it is better not to vow at all than to make a hasty vow. Okay? It's better to just keep your mouth shut. You can use that in simple terms. I promise to do this or that. Or you can look at it from real vows, actual vows, where you promise to God that you're going to do something. And in this case here, Jephthah actually vows a vow without considering the possibilities that could come of it. And so you have to ask yourself a lot of questions about how the law is going to be executed in these ways. And what is murder? What isn't murder? What does Yahweh allow? What doesn't he allow? Should a person do this or should a person do that? What the better options are? And I'm not 100% sure that we have an answer to what Jephthah did here in the future of this situation. I'm not sure there's a 100% legitimate answer to the question whether he actually goes through with it or whether he refrains from it and fulfills it in a different way. There's differences of opinion there. But what we know is that at this time, Yahweh accepts his vow. And he says, okay, Jephthah, I'm going to give these guys into your hand. But he was going to do that probably before Jephthah vowed anything to him. But Jephthah needed something a little more. And he smote them from Or, even till thou comes to Minnith, even 20 cities under the plain of the vineyards, with a very great slaughter. Thus the children of Ammon were subdued before the children of Israel. And Jephthah came to Mizpah unto his house, and behold, his daughter came out to meet him with timbrels, or a tambourine, and with a dance. And she was his only child. Besides her, he had neither a son nor daughter. And it came to pass when he saw her that he rent his clothes, and he said, alas, my daughter, thou hast brought me very low, and thou art one of them that trouble me, for I have opened my mouth unto Yahweh, and I cannot go back. And she said unto him, my father, if thou hast opened thy mouth unto Yahweh, do to me according that which thou proceeds out of thy mouth. For as much as Yahweh has taken vengeance for thee of thine enemies, even of the children of Ammon. And she said to her father, let this thing be done for me. Let me alone 2 months, that I may go up and down upon the mountains and bewail my virginity, I and my fellows. And he said, go, and he sent her away for 2 months, and she went with her companions and bewailed her virginity upon the mountains. I'm not exactly sure what that's all about either and what that means, but she's obviously lamenting the fact that she's never going to be married and that she's going to die a maid is what it seems like. Now, some people believe that what it's referring to is that she kind of became a nun And she decided to live as if she were dead, so to speak. Live as if she were a burnt offering and not get married and completely give herself to Yahweh in some other capacity, like I said, like a nun. I don't think there's enough evidence in the text to support that idea of nunnery. But in the same regard, there's a pretty big situation that's going on here, and Jephthah's going to make this choice. Came to pass at the end of 2 months, 39, and she returned unto her father, who did with her according to his vow, which he had vowed, and she knew no man. And it was a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went yearly to lament the daughter of Jephthah and the Gileadite 4 days in a year. Okay, as I said once again, that this situation is a pretty sad situation. And the text does tell us that he did with her according to the vow, and the vow did say burnt offering. So I have to say, from just the evidence of the text, while we don't want to accept it, and I definitely don't agree with it, and I don't think it was a pleasing thing for Yahweh, I think Jephthah, confused, maybe, used to other customs and other people's ways, other religions that were in the land, possibly. I mean, nothing here tells us that Jephthah was a great Christian person or a great lawkeeper of any sort. We know he's a Yahweh believer, but so are a lot of people that worship Baal. So the point of the matter is did Jephthah actually offer his daughter? I personally think the evidence points to say that that's probably what happened. And I'm also going to say that because of who Jephthah was, people didn't do anything about it because, that was just the way things were at this time in the book of Judges. I can't really come up with a better explanation for it, but it does sound that way. The possibility, however, that he didn't, and he just left her kind of become a nun and bewail her virginity and never get married and live in the tabernacle or something like that, kind of like the idea of presenting your body as a living sacrifice in the most literal of senses, other than sacrificial. I think some people take comfort in that idea because God wouldn't have liked the other understanding. But if you're going to take the Bible for what it says, there are some uncomfortable situations where Israel did things that were not pleasing to Yahweh, and they tolerated things that were not pleasing to Yahweh. And once you read about how some of the Baals were worshipped and how Ashtaroth was worshipped and how some of the gods of the Zidonians and Ammonites and Philistines and so on and so forth were worshipped, you'll see that as hard as it may sound, it sounds, this was not the worst thing that people did. Okay, this sounds very similar to what Moloch worship would represent. Okay, so unfortunately you have to cover these situations in reading through the book of Judges, so we just did. Study it out, take it for what it says, but by no means am I endorsing the idea, but I think that we can learn one thing, and that is it is better not to vow at all than for one to make a hasty vow. Think about what you do. God likes people who dwell upon judgment, another thing that we talked about this morning also. Now, the story of Jephthah goes on from here, and it ends in just a little bit, so we're going to cover this one last chapter. The men of Ephraim gathered themselves together and went northward. And they said unto Jephthah, wherefore passed thou over to fight against the children of Ammon, and did not call us to go with thee? So we have another one of these situations where Ephraim's going to start an argument. This time it's going to escalate. And he's starting an argument with another Israelite people, saying, why didn't you let us fight with you? You know, now we're angry. And did not call us to go with thee. Then he says, we will burn thine house upon thee with fire. And Jephthah said unto them, and my people were at great strife with the children of Ammon. And when I called you, ye delivered me not out of their hands. And when I saw that ye delivered me not, I put my life in my hands and passed over against the children of Ammon. And Yahweh delivered them into my hands, wherefore then are ye come up unto me this day to fight against me? And Jephthah gathered together all the men of Gilead, and he fought with Ephraim. And the men of Gilead smote Ephraim, because they said, "Ye Gileadites are fugitives of Ephraim among the Ephraimites and among the Manassites." And the Gileadites took the passage of Jordan before the Ephraimites. And it was so that when those Ephraimites which were escaped said, "Let me go over," that the men of Gilead would say unto him, "Art thou an Ephraimite?" And if he said, "Nay," then said they to him, "Say now Shibboleth," okay, or Kibboleth. And if he would say Kibboleth, for he could not frame to pronounce it right, then they took him and they slew him at the passages of the Jordan. And there fell at that time of the Ephraimites 42,000 over not pronouncing something that could mean a running brook or something like that. Now, just as a note, a linguistic note on this, some people put an SH and an S as the difference, but there's actually two completely different letters being put here if you were to read the Hebrew text. The difference isn't in an S and a CH, but it's in like an S and a C sound. Okay? K, as in like the way we would pronounce a C, like a C-ish G, if that's how it's even said. But the difference would be Kibboleth, I think, and Sibboleth. And our scripture in the King James says Shibboleth and Sibboleth. Okay? SH versus S. But the word Kibboleth actually has no meaning at all. It's not a, it has no Hebrew word. Okay? And why I think that's significant is because it's not like there's two ways to say this one word with an SH or an S sound, which could be in Hebrew that way. In other words, Kibboleth has, they have no way to pronounce it. Okay? It doesn't have a real meaning. It's not like saying an actual word. So, it caused the people to know whether or not this person could say it or couldn't, if he pronounced his S's like C's, which I think that we could think about the way Northerners and Southerners at one time spoke in America. It's becoming less and less due to televisions and radios, I think. But you can consider how people of different places pronounce different things. You can consider how the British pronounce words and Americans pronounce words. You know, the difference between aluminium versus aluminum, or things like that. You can see that people undoubtedly have a problem whenever they're stuck in a way of speaking, that they have to pronounce it the way they were raised, and they have to force themselves to try to frame the word differently. Not everybody can do that. You know, for instance, I know a person who says aluminum like there's three N's at the end of the word. Aluminum. They just can't stop themselves from saying it. True story. All right? Tried many times to get them to say it differently. They just can't. And I have to think that that has to be the same situation. A person just cannot, the majority of the population who lived on the other side of the river had to pronounce it the way that they were taught. It was just too hard for them to change it. So it tells us that they killed 42 people, though, over a mispronunciation. 42,000 people, yeah, over a mispronunciation. 42 would have been the good side of it. Jephthah judged Israel 6 years, then died Jephthah the Gileadite. And he was buried in one of the cities of Gilead. After him, Ibzan the Bethlehemite judged Israel. And he had 30 sons and 30 daughters whom he sent abroad, and he took in 30 daughters from abroad for his sons, and he judged Israel 7 years. Then died Ibzan, and he was buried at Bethlehem. And after him, Elon the Zebulunite judged Israel, and he judged Israel 10 years. And Elon the Zebulunite died and was buried in Ajalon in the country of Zebulun. After him, Abdon the son of Hillel, the Parathonite judged Israel, and he had 40 sons and 30 nephews that rode on 70 asses colts, and he judged Israel 8 years. And Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Perathonite, died and was buried in Perathon in the land of Ephraim, in the mount of the Amalekites. And that ends chapter 12. And I think we have a lot to think about when we consider the story of Jephthah compared to these other guys.